Kobe Jones. The Ravens' return man and wide receiver and is respected by our team and staff. He is big, powerful, and fast, and breaks right through arm tackles. Look, if we don't cover well and gang tackle, we won't control field position, Belichick explains bluntly as we watch Jones return a kick 108 yards for a touchdown during the season. Belichick's use of voice and video gets today's points across. Contain Flacco, win the third down battle, swarm Jones. Today's meeting is much shorter. Just before Belichick dismisses the players to the positional get-togethers, he informs them that practice will be in the stadium, adding unnecessarily that it will be bitter cold. Then, so as not to disappoint his players or mess with their routine, he leaves them with a touching farewell. Get your shit on and be ready. As it turns out, the wind is a massive problem, whipping from every direction and making it that much more unbearable. It doesn't bother Brady, of course. He throws the ball the best he has thrown it all week. He's remarkable, really. I wish every fan could see him at work like this. Sometimes I think watching Brady every day is like living at the foot of Everest. The magnificence almost becomes routine. Julian Edelman, meanwhile, looks like the best player on the field, and Gronk is moving well. The only disappointment is that LeGarrette Blount, our power back, has the flu and is sent off the field to the training room. After practice, as the team gathers around, Belichick reminds everyone to stay hydrated, no time for soft tissue injuries. At the post-practice staff meeting, Belichick lists the latest inactives. The Ravens, he notes, are healthy too. Jernigan and Monroe are banged up, but they should be ready. Then he reiterates, for the defensive coaches, their first priority. The certainty in his voice is unignorable. When they need a fucking play, he snarls, I'm telling you, they are going to Daniels. Wednesday, 3 days before kickoff. Today the schedule begins to vary a bit from our regular season routine. The next 2 days will run like a couple of usual Friday practices, no pads, and an intense focus on situational football. That means red zone work, third down situations, and Belichick's all-important, gotta-have-it plays. But it also means no evening meetings, and so the coaches can go home, get away from the facility, and recharge with some family time. At the full team meeting, Belichick cues up the Ravens-Steelers game. Belichick will spread the viewing and real-time analysis over a couple of sessions. He takes his time for two reasons. One, to adequately explain relevant game situations, and two, to drill down on the details of the few plays that cost the Steelers the chance to advance. You might think that once the lights go out, the players' wakefulness will soon follow, but that's not the case. Everyone is fully engaged, eyes on the screen, because they all know Belichick might call on them to answer some game situation question. You don't want to be the snoring guy when he does. Not if you want to stay a Patriot. We watched the first half and listened to Belichick review all the game-changing moments. The Steelers dominated time of possession, almost 21 minutes to 9, yet trailed 10 to 9. The reason? Too many drive-killing negative plays, including 3 sacks. And though Ben Roethlisberger threw for 183 yards with only 6 incompletions, the offense couldn't find the end zone. Without the injured Le'Veon Bell, the Steelers had no running game, and as Belichick reminds everyone, you cannot expect to beat the Ravens throwing the ball 60 times. It all comes back to basics. We need to control the line of scrimmage. We need to run the ball. We need to convert on third downs, especially in the red zone. Meanwhile, the Ravens' first scoring drive was assisted by a personal foul penalty on Steelers safety Mike Mitchell, and Belichick jumps all over that. These dumb fucking penalties are going to cost us, he says. We cannot have them. We have to stand up to these guys, but we cannot lose our composure. The team watches as the Steelers answer the Ravens' drive with 12 plays of their own that ended a field goal. But the drive was slowed by a first down sack that forced a 2nd and 19, one more chance for Belichick to hammer home his no negative plays, especially on first down mantra. As he puts it, there are 70 plays in a game. We need to make them all count. The tape stops at halftime. The screen goes dark, and the team disperses. Today's practice features the defensive backs working on long balls. Long balls are part of every Belichick practice, but this week they get even more attention because Flacco has drawn 15 pass interference penalties this season that eventually were converted into 56 points. We just don't practice covering the deep throws. We work on playing under throws too, reminding our defensive backs to get their heads turned around in time to play the ball while avoiding getting tangled up with the receiver. We are going to make the Ravens offense earn its points. Thursday, 2 days before kickoff. Today is Gotta Have It Day. It begins with an 8 a.m. meeting featuring part two of Belichick's review of Steelers-Ravens. We settle in as Baltimore opens the second half with the ball, and right away, it's the perfect storm for Professor Belichick. On third and two at their own 37, the Ravens take a shot down the field that, right on cue, results in a pass interference penalty because the Steeler in coverage, Antoine Blake, fails to find the ball in the air, the exact thing we worked on in yesterday's practice. It's a 32-yard gain. Always be ready for the shots and play the ball, Belichick says. During the next series, the Ravens take another shot. This one is a 40-yard completion on first down. We cannot sit back and wait on first down, Belichick preaches. The score goes to 20-9, and Belichick fast forwards, stopping only when the Ravens running back, Justin Forsett, fumbles at the Steelers 47 with the game seemingly in Baltimore's control at the start of the fourth quarter. This is how you lose games, not protecting the ball, Belichick says. One play later, the Steelers score a quick touchdown. After their two-point conversion fails, Belichick fast-forwards again to a third and long on the Ravens' next possession. It's a critical moment, and Belichick doesn't let it pass. The Ravens gotta have it, so who's getting the ball, he asks. A few faint votes for Owen Daniels echo in the dark room, and Belichick confirms. Right when they need a play, it's going to be Daniels. We have to get him. This is how Belichick inserts his game plan into the team's collective subconscious, one vital detail at a time. He plants the message, stopping Daniels is a key to winning. Then he proves it and repeats it using several different media until it's ingrained in our brains. Then Belichick shows us what happens when we don't follow the plan. The tape rolls. Daniels gets free, and the Ravens convert on their way to another field goal that puts them up 23-15. Roethlisberger throws an interception, and Belichick stops the tape. What's next? Again, a few unconvincing murmurs from the crowd, almost before Belichick has a chance to agree. Right, a shot. Ravens backup tight end Crockett Gilmore catches a 21-yard touchdown pass that ices the game. The Ravens beat the Steelers because they made all their gotta-have-it plays. It's a nice segue. Near the end of any preparation week, Belichick uses days like these to go over the plays and players he feels will be difference-makers in the game. First, he highlights Ravens wide receiver Michael Campanaro. God knows why. Campanaro is a seventh-rounder who has been active for only four games and did not have a single catch against the Steelers. It seems like guesswork or secret intel, but it's actually Belichick's powers of deductive reasoning that have led him to Campanaro. He knows one of our weaknesses on defense also happens to be one of the Ravens' strengths, the middle of the field. Campanaro, meanwhile, is quick and strong and can separate in the slot and win in man coverage. It's a calculated prediction, not a wild guess. We will keep our eye on Campanaro on Saturday. At practice, though, all eyes are on Alan Branch. The sun is out, but the weather is brutal, yet the players seem to be inspired. Branch, a defensive tackle we signed late in the year to bolster our depth along the line, works so hard that sweat freezes on his body. Friday, one day before kickoff. During the regular season, the day before a game is quick and easy. During the playoffs, nothing is. Belichick calls a last-second 7 a.m. coaches meeting before the full team meeting to go over final details and a few future projects. All the coaches are in their seats at least 10 minutes early, meaning that for once, Belichick is the last man in. This pleases him, and once seated at his spot, At the table head, he looks at his notes and then up at his staff and announces he wants everyone to review the previous four Patriots postseasons to uncover anything we may have missed in our preparation. He wants them watching, not through the lens of their particular unit or area of expertise, but as a team objective, independent observers. Of course, there is no assurance he will agree with their assessments or act on their recommendations, but no one doubts that he will process all the new information and won't hesitate to incorporate anything he deems worthwhile. More than anything, this is an exercise in staying focused on the big picture, leaving no stone unturned, seeing the game through fresh eyes and with a different perspective. Belichick then reiterates that he wants the team to play fast and aggressive, but most of all, poised. It's a fine line. We cannot let the Ravens push us around, but we cannot lose our composure. Finally, he demands a good start from our kicking game and precision in our two-minute drills. Belichick sends us off with this boiled-down report of the Ravens' mentality. They think they can cover Gronk with safety Will Hill, dominate our offensive front, and win. After the team meeting and walkthrough, the players are free until they have to report to the hotel for the 7 p.m. special teams meeting. The coaches work on the playoff project dutifully, typing up pages and pages of notes for the boss before heading home for a few hours. They pass Belichick's car in the parking lot. He doesn't go home on nights before a game. He works out, watches more tape, shuts the world out, and locks in on the task at hand. Belichick holds his evening coaches meeting at the local hotel the team stays at the night before the game. This session has always been one of my favorites. In it, Belichick goes over how he sees the game playing out and doles out parting instructions to his coordinators. The first order of business, though, is to finalize the inactive list. Then it's on to the officials. Belichick reviews all the Patriot games that Bill Vinovich, the head official assigned to our game, has done. He informs the staff that he actually went over the trick plays we might run with Vinovich to make sure we don't catch his crew off guard. Fans, players, and coaches alike forget that the pace of the game is just as fast for the officials as it is for the rest of us. Forcing them to figure out a proper call on an unusual circumstance in the heat of the moment is asking a lot. When it benefits us, we try to make life a little easier for them. Belichick doesn't worry about Vinovich spilling our plans to the Ravens. He's not worried about the play's legality either, because he's already had a chat with the league office about the rules. The man leaves nothing to chance. Not that he doubted the legality of the play. It had already been confirmed by his own resident rules pundit, Ernie Adams. Many people have asked me what Adams actually does for Belichick. As far back as Cleveland, owner Art Modell would say, "I will pay $10,000 to the person who can tell me what Ernie Adams does." Adams doesn't attend meetings, nor does he coach a position. He's a confidant of Belichick, a trusted friend, a sounding board, another set of eyes and ears, and a legitimate rules expert. He knows the rule book as well as the head of officials probably better. Add his great understanding of the history of the game, and Adams is an incredible resource and comfort for Belichick. The coach confers with him on replay challenges, and he's always nearby when Belichick is in a conversation with the refs. Adams also brings me to the elephant in the room. Call me a Kool-Aid drinker if it makes you feel better, but here's the fact. The Patriots don't cheat. Okay, maybe they do a little, but only stuff that all the teams in the NFL do to try to gain an advantage. And I'm not talking about unbalanced line play here. That's just knowing the rules, pushing things right up to the edge in an effort to gain every possible advantage. It's not cheating, although it's often portrayed that way. I'm talking about the biggie. Filming another team's signals. It was wrong, and they paid a hefty price. Draft picks, fines, and permanent damage to the franchise's reputation. But they were doing only what other teams have done and will continue to do. How do I know? Because I have worked for some of the great signal stealers in the game. I am not going to dime anyone out. I'm no rat. But trust me, it happens all the time. In fact, it happens so often that everyone in the NFL knows who the signal stealers are and makes sure to hide their calls when they play them. And as much as it happens in the NFL, it happens much more in the college game, where the absence of radio communication means they have to call plays from the sideline. My point is that the Patriots push the envelope and leave no stone unturned to a degree that is unmatched in football. Just don't confuse Belichick's obsession with all-out preparation for cheating. It ain't. And don't get me started on Deflategate. That was not some sinister conspiracy. I'm not sure it was anything at all. What I do know is that no one in the building that I talked to, Belichick included, had any idea about any of it. Belichick ends his final meeting with directions for each and every coach. He starts with special teams, urging O'Brien and his assistant Joe Judge to make a play before getting a little dig that he gleaned from my research. In our last 9 postseason games, our special teams took 10 penalties. We cannot continue to beat ourselves, Belichick says. No one disagrees. He turns to McDaniels to let him know that he wants the offense to put our best groups out there early so that we start fast and play with the lead. Most teams have an offensive script that doles out when each contributor gets involved, and that script depends on game situation and management. Because Belichick wants that early lead, he wants almost nothing held back. Not formations, not players, not core plays. Playing with the lead, he says, is crucial against Kubiak, because it forces him into more drop-back formations, which are not a strong suit of his schemes. In this mode, Belichick comes across as a chess grandmaster who is playing out both sides of the board in his head at all times, not just his moves, but everything his opponent might do to counter them. Belichick continues down his list. He wants to check from run to pass, not just pass to run. He wants to support Solder, our offensive tackle, early in the game against Suggs, with a chip-blocking running back. He wants everyone to be sure where the yardage sticks are on crucial downs and to be aware that the Ravens will be all over Gronk on first and second downs. He wants to make first downs on all second and shorts to stay out of third downs. He wants McDaniels to remember that once he sees their defensive game plan, he will know their game plan. The Ravens don't make many adjustments. He wants the offense to spread the Ravens out deep in our own territory. Finally, he tells McDaniels the one play he does want to save for the second half, our unbalanced line play, or what has come in the last week to be known as the Baltimore play. I don't want them to have time to adjust, Belichick explains, thinking that using it in the first half would preclude his coming back to it in the second half because the Ravens would have halftime to study it. As for the defense, Belichick emphasized keeping the line fresh for the fourth quarter because he senses the game will come down to the final minutes as so many of the past battles with the Ravens have. Belichick tells Patricia he wants to start the game with calls we're familiar with to avoid early mistakes. He wants us playing clean, sharp, and fast. Plus, he'd rather get Kubiak to show his hand and then make the necessary adjustments before running more exotic calls. Belichick is still worried about cut blocks and wants to make sure the coaches in the skybox are paying close attention to how our defensive linemen are being handled. He reminds Patricia one more time to keep an eye on Campanaro and lets him know to expect more 11 personnel, one tight end, one back, from the Ravens on first down while warning about assuming they're going to run the ball out of 12 personnel, one tight end, two backs. Belichick is pretty confident they will come out throwing regardless of the formation. After encouraging everyone to keep his poise and focus and to forget about bad plays as soon as they happen, there's nothing more to do or say. The planning is over. It's time to play. Saturday, pregame. The team, even Brady, spends the night at a hotel, and the next morning Belichick addresses them before everyone heads to the stadium. He is no rah-rah Rockne type. His well-worn monotone never rises or betrays emotion. Think Dragnet's Joe, just the facts, ma'am, Friday. Still, the players don't know quite what to expect from this meeting, as Belichick never does the same thing twice. This time, Belichick shows the team a short tape of the season's positive plays to reinforce the fact that when we focus and do things correctly, we are tough to beat. Everyone is feeling pretty good as he stresses one more time what we need to do to win. He finishes with a short discourse about sticking together. handling the inevitable ups and downs of the game and never giving in, just as Chris Kyle never gave in. It's not especially eloquent, but it's remarkably prescient. Meeting over, Belichick drives directly to the office to start his final preparation. He goes over the practice video once more on the off chance that something has escaped his notice. He is not looking to have a conversation. He values this alone time. We all know better than to break his quiet focus. Even when he brings the video to the weight room to watch during his pregame workout, he is left alone, a prize fighter before a championship bout. His weatherman's prediction is accurate. The shining sun is fighting a losing battle. Once night falls, it will be even worse, and that is bound to have an adverse effect on our home field advantage. It's not that the fans won't show up. Of course they will. It's that they will all be bundled up in scarves and gloves, and that will deaden the noise in the stands. After watching the first half of the Seahawks-Panthers game in my office, I'm pretty convinced that Seattle will be the NFC's representative in the Super Bowl. The Seahawks lead at halftime 14-10, but I know from the scouting I did in the weeks leading up to the playoffs that they are a dominant fourth quarter team, so an early deficit against them is hard to overcome. They just keep grinding until they wear you down. I see little hope for Carolina. As I walk onto the field an hour and a half before kickoff, the stadium looks like a postcard. The sky is dark, but the moon is a lamppost. It's a perfect night for football. Saturday, game time. As is the norm, when the Patriots win the coin toss, we defer, hoping for a dominant three and out to set the tone. But today, despite all the time, energy, and expertise we put into preparing for the Ravens, very little goes as planned. And that begins with the coin toss tactic. Just as Belichick said they would, the Ravens come out firing. They throw on nearly every first down, another Belichick prediction, and score in just five plays. Before our fans have even settled into their seats, we're down 7-0. So much for starting fast. We certainly didn't game plan for this. To make matters worse, our offense starts slowly too. After one first down, we're forced to punt. We've been preparing for this game around the clock for a week, and 5 minutes in, the team has done nothing Belichick asked of it. But just as he preached at our staff meeting on Tuesday morning, Belichick shows no signs of panic. He's as calm as he can be on the headset. You think we were up three scores by the tenor of his voice. Maybe a little panic is in order, though, because on their next drive, the Ravens march down the field again, in 11 plays this time, mixing the run and the pass to go up 14-0. The stadium falls deathly silent. Mike Tyson has a great line that he may or may not have borrowed from Joe Louis. Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. That is exactly what just happened to us, and that makes all the work we did to prepare exponentially more important. We have to stick with the plan. Our interior line holds the Raven pass rushers at bay, and with time and space, Brady begins to chip away. Getting the ball to Gronk and others, we answer quickly, scoring a touchdown from the 4-yard line with Brady running it in on 3rd and short. Yes, Brady ran it in. Apparently, someone was listening to Belichick preach all week about the importance of converting on 3rd downs in the red zone. Gronk, by the way, will never come off the field and will end up with 108 yards receiving. Later, after our defense steps up, Edelman has a 19-yard punt return that gives us good field position. Our special teams play is tilting the field in our favor, and suddenly it makes sense that Belichick led off every meeting with that unit. Now the game feels more like the one Belichick envisioned. Moving the ball down the field with his arm this time, Brady caps off the drive with a touchdown pass to Amendola to tie the score. With just under 4 minutes to go in the half, if we can stop the Ravens one more time, we can use the next two possessions, the last of this half and the first of the next half, to build the lead. And then wham, another sock to the jaw. Brady throws a rare interception, and you'll never guess who the Ravens go to when they need a touchdown at the end of the half, right? Daniels. Or as Belichick referred to him all week, fucking Daniels. It's as if the entire team slept through our week of game prep. We squander our first possession of the second half too, and Baltimore scores again to take a 28-14 lead. If there was no panic before, that's no longer the case. Now the headsets carry a definite urgency and maybe even a hint of fear. From everybody but Belichick, that is. Instead, as the offense takes the field, the coach instructs McDaniels that it's time to break out the Baltimore play. Belichick has a keen sense of timing, rhythm, and momentum, especially in bigger games, and he realizes that we no longer have the luxury of holding anything back. Of course, the mere fact that he has such a play in his pocket, like one of the gadgets in Batman's utility belt, or a break glass in case of emergency cabinet, is remarkable in and of itself. It's as if he knew we needed something like this to rattle the Ravens and shake us out of our deep freeze. If I didn't know better, I'd say Belichick enjoyed using our reputation for playing fast and loose with the rules to our advantage. The unbalanced look completely baffles the Ravens, setting their staff into a wild frenzy. We gained 16 yards on the play, not bad, if less than we were looking for, but it delivers a secondary benefit. It sends the Ravens bench into a tailspin. The cheating Pats are doing it again. That's how I interpret their body language anyway. Across the field, head coach John Harbaugh is apoplectic, screaming and ranting at Vinovich. Apparently, he doesn't know the NFL rulebook and, or he missed the Alabama-LSU game. Belichick sees how much the play has flustered Baltimore, so he decides to go for the jugular and double down. Run it again, he tells McDaniels. This time we flip the formation. This one's called Raven, and the play gains 14 yards. But the impact is much greater. Harbaugh looks as though he might stroke out before getting called for an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty that moves us inside their 5-yard line. I'm pretty sure that's what Belichick referred to during Wednesday's film study as a dumb fucking penalty. Two plays later, we score. It's 28-21. My intimations of panic have dissipated. The crowd is going nuts. The Ravens are rattled. Game on. With our defensive linemen fighting off the Ravens' cut blocks and our corners and safeties limiting Flacco's chunk plays downfield, we get the ball back at our 30. Over the headsets, I hear Belichick remind McDaniels about the double pass play. It works perfectly as Edelman heaves it to Amendola to tie the score. The Ravens are on the ropes, but Harbaugh doesn't seem to get it. He's still bitching about those unbalanced formations. It almost makes you feel sorry for him. Almost. As the fourth quarter begins, Baltimore goes on a 15-play drive that brings them to a 3rd and 7 at our 7. This is clearly a gotta-have-it play. Every Patriot knows where the ball is going. We prepare for this moment, and now all we have to do is operationalize Belichick's mantra. Practice execution becomes game reality. The coaches and Belichick are yelling that we have to get Daniels. On cue, Flacco sends a pass toward his tight end, who is double covered. The ball sails over his head, and the Ravens have to settle for a field goal. Fun fact, the Ravens finished just 1 of 9 on third down, while the Patriots converted 6 of 11, and it proves to be the difference in the game. Knowing we can take our first lead of the game, Brady marches us 74 yards, capping things off with a 23-yard touchdown pass to LaFell, bad toe and all. With the front of the pocket clean, Brady was repeatedly able to step up, avoid Suggs on the edge. He managed just a half a sack in the game and passed for 367 yards. Now with slightly more than 5 minutes to play, Belichick and the staff urged the players to stay in the moment. Our defense is fresh, remembering Belichick's instructions this morning to keep something in the tank for a late desperate surge by the Ravens. The final minutes of a playoff game are a now or never war, football at its best. The Ravens' next drive involves all their receivers, including Campanaro, who makes a tough catch over the middle. Right before the 2-minute warning, the Ravens are confronted with a 4th and 3. When they break the huddle, Belichick takes a Kodak, a quick mental picture of the Ravens' formation, to try to predict what they will run. But on this, the ultimate gotta-have-it play, we know what's coming next, a pass to Daniels. We know it, but we just can't stop it. The Ravens convert. We know not to take stupid penalties too, but we jump offside. Anyway, gift wrapping a 2nd and 5 for the Ravens. But we also know this. When you're in four down territory, the best time to take a shot is on second down. And when Flacco does a poor job of looking off, the safety Daron Harmon intercepts the ball. The pick seals the win. The Patriots become the first team in playoff history to overcome two 14-point deficits. The game was a war. We took their best shots, stayed together, stuck to the plan, kept fighting, and turned my memo into memories. Chapter 8. While I have you, my biggest pet peeves. I'm not looking to be consistent. I'm looking to be correct. Al Davis. Do you know what the most significant invention of the 21st century is? The mute button on the television remote. Bruce Springsteen was right when he sang that there were 57 channels and nothing on, because today I have my choice of more than 257 channels, and I swear I'm still at a loss. Unless there's football, of course. Thank goodness for the gridiron. I don't care who's playing, whether it's college or pro, I just love to man my position as a professional armchair quarterback. When football is on the big screen, I'm constantly chirping to Millie, or let's be honest, to no one at all, that whoever I'm watching should do this or call that or try the other thing. It can be annoying, I'll admit, but it keeps my instincts sharp. I watch some basketball too, especially when former NBA coach Hubie Brown is the analyst. It's as if he's coaching both teams at all times. We're kindred spirits. He watches his game the way I like to think I watch mine. But you don't have to sit with me long to realize that I get irritated quickly. Not with the game, but with the way most commentators describe or don't describe what's happening on the field. That's where the mute button comes in. I'm not blaming the men doing the talking. I know that's a tough gig. It's just that my training in the sport allows me to see things they don't notice, and I just can't turn it off. Ask Millie. One of the big problems is that the analysts are almost all former players who are blinkered by the perspective of the position they played. They don't see the whole field. It's not their fault. It's just their background, and to be fair, the nature of their sport. In baseball, players play offense and defense. In basketball, same thing. Football is way more specialized. You can go to positional meetings all week, heck, all year, and never have any idea of your team's overall game plan. When Hall of Fame Cleveland Browns tight end Ozzie Newsome retired and became a personnel man, he told me, "I have no idea what actually happens upstairs." Why would he? During his playing career, he was focused only on his position and responsibilities. Ozzie sure was a quick study, though. Within a decade, he was hoisting the Lombardi Trophy with the Ravens. Football strategy may not be rocket science, but there's more to it than meets the eye. Fans critique a particular play call or coverage breakdown without having any idea of the broader narrative. What seems obvious to them is almost never really what's taking place. What all you armchair quarterbacks need to do is turn the sound down and instead take your cues from the guys who may have a broader understanding of the game. That's where I come in. Here are some of my pet peeves, common strategy mistakes that continue to spoil my weekends, along with an explanation of what's actually going on. Each is sick-making enough in its own right. The fact that they occur again and again with a stunning lack of on-air critique just compounds my dyspepsia. I like to think that some of what follows, should it be heard by those with influence, will cause changes in strategy on the field or at least in the broadcast booth, but I have my doubts. I am fairly confident that after you hear it, I won't be the only one screaming at the TV as I stab at the mute button every Sunday. When they call time with 2:05 on the clock. At crunch time in the NFL, Andy Reid is the one guy who can make me scream in agony as if I'm watching Santino heading toward the toll plaza in The Godfather. When his Chiefs are in the 2-minute drill, my pleas of, "Sonny, no, it's a trap," become, "Andy, no, it's a trap." But Santino never listens, and Reed never learns. Funny thing is, the current Kansas City coach is one of the game's best. In 19 seasons as an NFL head man, he has amassed 183 wins and has taken his teams to 24 playoff games, 5 conference championship games, and a Super Bowl in 2004 when his Eagles lost to the Patriots. His resume speaks for itself, but his playoff work comes up short. He's 11-13 overall in the postseason and 1-4 with the Chiefs. There's plenty of reasons for that, but one of the major problems is surely his shortcomings in late game management. As good as a coach as Reed is, he often leaves me scratching my head or yelling at the TV after making the same mistake again and again. Here's what I'm talking about. The game is in the fourth quarter with 2 minutes and a few seconds on the clock, and Reed's team needs the ball back. On 2nd and 10, the opponent calls a running play. The defense holds for a short game, and Reed uses his last timeout to stop the clock once more before the 2 minute warning. At that point, I promptly lose my shit. Worse, no one with a microphone and access to millions of viewers bothers to point out what a huge blunder this is or suggest that it might be time for Reed to outsource his clock management. Calling a timeout in this situation is a gift to the opponent, providing more options for the offense. Thanks to Andy's ill-timed timeout, the offense can throw on third down without worrying that an incompletion will help the Chiefs by stopping the clock. The 2 minute warning is going to do that anyway. If Reed lets the clock run to the 2 minute warning though, everyone in the stadium knows the offense will be running the ball on that crucial third down to keep the clock running. Once it ticks past 2:06, the defense has to let it run down to the 2 minute warning. Has to. When Reed calls that defensive timeout, he thinks he's saving seconds for his offense. He's not. But even if he is, he's missing the point. For a trailing offense at that stage of the game, the entire focus needs to be on the potential number of plays it can still run. As football math has it, each play takes about 6 seconds. So if you want to think like a coach, don't look at the clock and think there are 54 seconds left in the game. Think best case scenario. I have time to run 9 more plays. When a team is down late and the game is on the line, offenses have to recalibrate to value plays more than time and yards more than first downs. The goal is to win. To win, you need points. To get points, you need yards. To get yards, you need plays, but more than the 3 seconds re-saved. Defensive head coaches should be able to do the plays to time left calculation in their heads, but the shrieks coming from my den every weekend are proof that they can't. If Reed were Al Davis's head coach, Davis might have watched him call that pre-2 minute warning timeout once. If he saw it again, Reed would be looking for a job. I'm not kidding. Davis understood game management theory. In fact, Bill Parcells, one of the best game managers ever, was schooled by Davis. Both Parcells and Belichick have been mocked for not celebrating after big late game touchdowns. But it's not because they're joyless so much as because they're already deep in thought about calculating time scenarios to decide the next thing the team needs to do. You can celebrate after the game. When Reed faced Belichick in Super Bowl 39 in 2005, his Eagles were down 24-14 with 5:40 to go. I guess having 2 timeouts left robbed Reed of the proper urgency because to the amazement of the entire Patriots coaching staff and a worldwide audience, the Eagles started their next drive as if the game were still in the first half. They scored, but it took them an eternity, almost 4 minutes, which left them no time to see whether the defense could get them the ball back. The Eagles were forced to try an onside kick, which they didn't recover. Almost 11 years later, Reed faced the Patriots again, this time with the Chiefs in the 2015 divisional round. Again, his team was down by 2 touchdowns late, and again history, or should I say Reed, repeated itself. With 6:29 to go and all 3 timeouts, the Chiefs took over with the same kind of non-urgency we saw in Philadelphia. They scored, but only after 16 plays that burned more than 5 minutes. Another desperation onside kick did not deliver. Once again, Andy Reid was left to suffer the same sad fate as Sonny. Corollary 1, when they throw checkdowns in the 2-minute drill. When I was in Cleveland, I sat in on a film session with our scouts after a day spent working on our 2-minute drill. Watching one useless checkdown throw, You know, those safe tosses to a receiver, usually a running back in the flat, after another got me more and more annoyed until I finally had to say something. Most of the scouts in the room turned and looked at me as if I were speaking in tongues. To them, it seemed obvious. We needed to get first downs. To me, it was just as obvious. No, we didn't. Unless it was fourth down, of course. Last I checked, they don't give points for first downs. What we really needed was the maximum yards we could get in the smallest amount of time. I tried to explain to those scouts that throwing a checkdown in that situation is actually a big-time favor to the defense because you voluntarily burn what you need most, time on the clock, in exchange for what you need least, first downs. When you measure the risk-reward as it relates to that situation, throwing the ball downfield seems like the only smart choice. Even if it's down the middle of the field, either you're going to get a big chunk of yards or the pass is going to be incomplete and stop the clock. But to do that, you have to have coaches and a quarterback who think like a professional golfer teeing off in front of a lake. That guy isn't worried about hitting the ball into the water. He can't even see the water. If he's laying up with a short wedge to play it safe, he won't be on the tour very long. He focuses only on what's beyond the lake. Plunking one in the water never enters his mind. That's the way a quarterback and his coaches need to handle a 2-minute drill. To be fair, it goes against almost all normal training. We talk about completion percentages and accuracy and read progressions all day long. But in a 2-minute drill, that all has to go out the window as the quarterback looks downfield because, as crazy as it sounds, a long incompletion is much better than a 5-yard checkdown. Corollary 2, when they don't consider all the factors. Let's check in on the Falcons-Eagles 2017 divisional playoff game. The Eagles are up 15-10 with just over 6 minutes to play, but the Falcons are starting a drive that will determine their entire season. Eventually, after running 4+ minutes off the clock, Atlanta finds itself first and goal at the Eagles' 9-yard line, on the doorstep of a second straight NFC championship game. The situation looks so dire for the Eagles that with 1:19 to play, they call a timeout in an attempt to stockpile precious seconds for a last-ditch drive after the Falcons inevitably score. Okay, time for a pop quiz. What should the Falcons call? At this point in the game, they have two goals. Obviously, first and foremost, they want to score. But second, and almost as important, they want to force the Eagles to burn their final timeout. Not for nothing, the Eagles kicker made a 53-yarder at the end of the first half. So if the Eagles do get the ball back, having that timeout to stop the clock and set up a kick could be the difference in the game. Knowing this, the Falcons' first down call has to be a run or an easily completable pass, right? Something that runs the clock and forces the Eagles to use their final timeout. Because once that happens, even a high school coach understands that Atlanta will have full control of the game. But what do the Falcons do? They throw a 50-50 pass into the end zone that falls incomplete. I'm sure there are many experts who would argue that this was smart, trying to get the ball to their best player, Julio Jones. Sorry, fellas. Right idea, wrong time. On second down, the Falcons call a quick screen. Incomplete. The clock is now at 1:11. Forget for a moment that those two plays didn't move the ball an inch closer to the end zone. The real problem is that they used up only 8 seconds and the Eagles still have their emergency timeout. Talk about not understanding the whole situation. When a world-class pool player makes a shot, where she leaves the cue ball matters almost as much as pocketing the ball. An amateur at your local watering hole is thinking one shot at a time, but the pro is imagining the best way to run the entire table from the get-go. Falcons head coach Dan Quinn isn't thinking like a pool shark. His goal needed to be centered on the big picture. He needs to see the entire field, not just the next shot or the next play. Now it's third down, a short completion. At least this causes the Eagles to burn their last timeout in order to set up their defense and save clock. The clock now reads 1:05, but it almost doesn't matter. Atlanta has completely botched this series. Even if the Falcons score on fourth down, the Eagles have more than enough time to get in field goal range and win the game. The Falcons don't score, of course. Quarterback Matt Ryan throws an end zone fade to Jones, who falls down and gets back up just in time for the ball to sail through his fingertips. Before the ball even hit the ground, everyone was talking about how the Eagles' defense heroically held and saved the season. Nobody even mentioned the real story, how the Falcons' offense blew it. At least I don't think anyone was. I was screaming my objections too loud to hear them if they were. When they try to run it back. Few things demonstrate a nearly total lack of understanding of even the simplest aspects of clock management than late game kickoff returns. Here's the situation. Team B, down to its last timeout and is trailing by four with less than a minute left, fields a kickoff 3 yards deep in the end zone and advances the ball to the 22-yard line as 8 seconds tick off the clock. The announcers, of course, begin to talk about what the offense now has to do. They have nothing to say about what just happened. Well, I do. What the hell were they thinking? The geniuses on Team B just gave up 8 seconds, or one or two extra chances to win the game, in order to lose 3 yards on the kick return. Here's the math. The chances of breaking that return for a game-winning touchdown are virtually non-existent. In 2017, only 4 of the 966 kickoffs were taken to the house. That's a success rate below 0.5%. Titans quarterback Marcus Mariota, who had 5 game-winning drives in 2017, beat those odds all by himself. Even more to the point, just 4 teams in 2017 had an average after-kickoff starting point beyond the 25-yard line. The Ravens were best at 27.8. Trust me, this obvious miscalculation would never happen in New England or anywhere else where the head coach understands time management even a little. In fact, Bill Belichick figured out early on that it actually made sense to lure the not-so-smart teams into making this mistake. Instructing his kicker to leave the ball short of the goal line, he forced a return that burned precious seconds. Teams should be smarter than this, but you'd be surprised. When they stretch for the extra yard. What's the number one requirement of a ball carrier? To score? Nope. To gain yards? Nope. The first rule of ball carriers is to protect the rock. Yet more and more it seems runners near the goal line extend their ball carrying arm to break the plane or touch the pylon to get a touchdown. Similarly, ball carriers have taken increasingly to cradling the ball as if it were a loaf of bread. The problem is that defenses have gotten better at playing the ball and knocking it loose. Most defenses, in fact, run daily drills in which they practice stripping the ball. It's time well spent when you consider that teams that win the turnover battle win the game nearly 80% of the time. That's from a Harvard study, so you can trust it. Think about that stat the next time you see a runner expose the ball to stretch for a measly extra yard. Even near the goal line, I'm telling you, the risk is not worth the reward. In New England, players are reminded that carrying the ball is a privilege. If a player abuses that privilege with fumbles or by carrying the ball carelessly, he will lose that privilege until he earns it back. Belichick would never encourage extending the ball near the goal line. He means it when he says he never wants the ball to be unprotected. Of course, there will be times when an overzealous Patriot ignores the edict, but even if he scores, he can expect to get an earful from his coach. God help him if the ball comes loose. When they settle for the long field goal. Late in games, as soon as a team that's down by at least 2 points gets anywhere near midfield, television producers slap that virtual line onto the screen to indicate where the field goal kicker's range begins. Now, you might think that it's a cool innovation, graphics, or a helpful visual guide. And I might even agree, if not for the fact that it actually highlights the wrong target. Remember, the line represents the outer reaches of the kicker's range. Time constraints aside, why would that be any offense's goal? The point isn't to get into field goal range. The point is to get into surefire field goal range. This is no small difference. an offense that can move the ball just 11 more yards and decrease the length of the attempt from, say, 50 yards down to 39 has increased its odds of scoring points by more than 20%. Too many teams grow significantly more conservative once they get the ball into field goal range because they don't want to give up the chance to get 3 points. But they shouldn't just want a chance. They should want a real chance. Why pile more pressure on an already pressure-filled situation? Forcing a kicker to achieve at the edge of his capabilities in a must-make-it moment is not a winning formula. For a head coach who needs to factor in weather changes, injuries, and his kicker's fluctuating mental state, field goal range has to be a moving target, not a static line. Corollary, missed field goals are actually turnovers. What has always bothered me about missed field goals is that they're always filed away in the wrong statistical category. They're not missed field goals. They're turnovers. Think about it. After a miss, there's a change of possession and a loss of yardage as the ball placement is 7 yards behind the original line of scrimmage. In 2017, kickers converted 69%, 107 of 154, of field goal attempts from beyond 50 yards. That means that in a game of inches, an offense handed the ball over to the defense near midfield 47 times. Sure sounds like turnovers to me. Why do we continue to pretend otherwise? When they don't give themselves a chance. There's a moment in the fourth quarter of every closest game in which it transforms into an onside kick game. You know what I mean? A team is up 2 scores, and the only way an opponent can come back and win is if it manages to secure an extra possession with a successful onside kick. What's funny, though, is how few of those games actually ever end that way. Teams are so focused on scoring a touchdown first, they fail to leave themselves enough time to kick a field goal even if they can get the ball back. I know traditional thinking on this is that you want to hang on to the chance to win the game as long as possible, even if that chance is contingent on a miracle turnover or broken play, which means you don't want to go for a field goal first because if you miss, the game's over right then. But I've always thought such thinking is too rigid. You need 2 scores. It makes no difference to anyone but the gamblers what order you get them in. Doesn't it actually make more sense to move the ball in a makeable field goal range as fast as possible to give yourself the most time to get that touchdown? I learned this by watching Parcells when he was coaching the Patriots. He'd factor in intangibles such as timeouts left, weather, the kicker's confidence and range, and the moment a drive feels like it has stalled. But he was never afraid to follow his gut and attempt a field goal first, even if it meant facing the wrath of the media and all the other armchair quarterbacks out there. You know why? Because it was the right move. When the goal is third and manageable. On first down, the offense doesn't gain any yardage, which prompts the announcers to proclaim that it now needs to spend second down getting into a third and manageable situation, which then prompts me to proclaim that nobody knows anything. I'm sorry, but isn't the goal to score? Who designs plays to gain 3 or 4 yards? Shouldn't you call every play with the idea that it could break for a big game? Look, I understand that sometimes you have to manage a situation and make keeping a drive alive your priority. But more often than not, this is not the case. I might feel differently if third and manageable solved an offense's scoring problems. It doesn't. The truth is, most NFL play callers don't even understand what third down and manageable actually means. Most will define it as 3rd and 6. In the last few years, however, the average conversion rate for this down and distance has been about 26%. Getting in third and manageable might sound like a solid plan. But shouldn't a solid plan have a success rate better than 1 in 4? Third down in general is a tough position to be in. The game buckles down on third down. Defenses are designed for just such situations. Even the best teams convert third downs at only about a 45% rate. The league average in 2017 was 38%. In the end, the best third down strategy is to avoid third downs altogether. Instead of teams trying to get into third and manageable situations, I proposed that they'd be better off taking their cues from the Canadian Football League. I'm serious. The CFL gives offenses three downs, not four, so they never have to concern themselves with third and manageable because they only have two chances to make a first down. In the CFL, every play call needs to be aggressive. A part of me thinks the CFL style is where the offensive philosophy is headed. Why wait until third down to fight to keep the drive going? Sweetening the pot, most defenses are still in their basic schemes on second down, and so their best pass rushers aren't even on the field. Why not take a shot when you have the advantage? Sooner or later, defenses will adjust and begin using nickel passing packages on second downs. And that will be just fine, too, because then every down will be an equal fight for a first down, and third and manageable situations will be history, which they should be. When they don't tell us who is in the game. NFL football today is about one thing above all else, matchups. In basketball, analysts highlight changes in the lineup all the time, announcing stuff such as Team A has gone small to cause problems for the much slower Team B. Why don't football analysts do this more often? Even well-informed fans can get lost in the different formations and personnel disguises, missing the significance of the constantly rotating matchups that are now the key to most NFL games. It wouldn't be that hard to communicate this before every snap. Every personnel group is described with two digits, the first indicating the number of running backs and the second the number of tight ends. If the Patriots come out in 11 personnel, they have one back and one tight end on the field, and thus probably three wideouts. The defense would more than likely counter with its nickel package, three defensive backs. The play-by-play guy could just mention this quickly, or the networks could just add 11P/nickel to the bug on the screen graphic that displays score, time, and down and distance. Some announcers do a good job of mentioning a two tight end set that suggests a running play or an empty backfield that foretells a pass. But it would be nice if they did this on every down. That way we'd know that if Belichick stays in 11 personnel, we should focus on the depth in the defensive backfield. And then if the Patriots gain 150 yards rushing from that package, we can rightfully expect the media to ask about the nickel defense's porous run support. Too often, though, fans watching at home have no idea what personnel group is in the game. And if they don't know this, how can they understand the point-counterpoint drama going on at field level? Plus, imagine the second-guessing that would occur if fans actually had the information necessary to second-guess. When an eight-man front gets way too much credit. Another thing that drives me nuts when a commentator offers a simple solution to a complex problem, such as when a team is running the ball and he suggests that the defense needs to jump into an eight-man front. Yes, the vaunted eight-man front. They mention it as if it were the antidote to every potent ground game. But if the eight-man front always stopped the run, there wouldn't be any 1,000-yard rushers, right? In the same way that third and manageable is a misnomer, the eight-man run-stuffing fronts aren't actually made up of eight run-stuffers. Rather, they include a member of the secondary, usually a safety, who is moved up into the box. He's not a typical run stopper, yet his responsibility is the same as that of those who are much bigger and much better at it. Furthermore, there are eight gaps that need to be defended on any run play, and if the defense isn't properly aligned at all times to man all those ever-moving, ever-changing gaps, it won't help you if you have an 18-man front stacked in the box. Al Davis never learned. He loved eight-man fronts. But all Denver had to do to beat the Raiders was stretch their offense with a series of simple bootleg plays. Because as soon as the eight-man front lost gap control, it became more like a six-man front. Then the Broncos could run the ball up and down the field. The Raiders never budged. Davis was the only coach who believed in eight-man fronts more than TV talking heads do. When they make it more complicated than it is. All a quarterback cares about is this. Is the middle of the field open or closed? That's it. If the middle of the field is open, it means the safeties are playing a cover two shell, and that in turn means that the front will be a seven-man defense. If the middle of the field is